Do me a favor, give this to Michael Miller. He owes me. Michael, you owe my wife an answer.
What's this, Grace will talk to her tonight.
Oh, okay. Good. Remind Grace.
Yeah, I haven't forgot.
Okay. Okay, let's roll. We're recording?
Huh?
Okay. It's October 20th. It's 20th, am I right? No, that's a mistake.
25th.
I'm looking at the wrong thing. I'm looking at, okay. It's October 25th, 2010. I want to say good morning to the many sitting in front of me and the many, many, many more listening across the world. We're in the middle of Rav Shaul Lieberman. We're dealing with Conservative Judaism. We're dealing with the seminary. And last week we dealt with Rav Shaul Lieberman's life. And the whole question of here we have for the first time an individual, unlike Mordechai Kaplan, Lahavdil between them, unlike Louis Ginsburg, here is a man who no one questions the fact he remained a total, committed, observant, Orthodox Jew. And yet he came to the seminary. And I showed you with interviews with Professor Liebman speaking himself, where he explained that no one in the world could give him the conditions he had at the seminary. He taught 2 hours a week, 4 hours a week. The rest of the time he could devote the scholarship, and no one interfered with his locking himself in his office and working on the Tosefta. Of course, this raises the question that was at the heart of last week's shiur: does this justify being part of the seminary? Rabbi Rubin, who generally has a liberal point of view, took a very extreme point of view and absolutely, totally, completely condemned Rav Shaul Lieberman. And many of my colleagues, many of the Rosh Hashiva at YU, would certainly condemn him. I simply wanted you to be attuned. Life is not black and white, and I have to admit in public, Rabbi Rubin challenged me last week, so I admit in public I could not teach at the seminary no matter what. Then again, I'm not Shaul Lieberman, so let me not overstate the case, but even as Aaron Rakefet, I could not teach at the seminary. Nevertheless,
in 1940.
No, 1940.
It's
but
a tremendous difference.
I believe me, I know it, and we'll get there. But nevertheless, and let me put it this way, I could not teach at the seminary 1965, okay? Now, nevertheless, I called your attention to the poverty that Rav Shaul Lieberman endured. And this is something that only if you've been through it can you understand it. And he was a man who was a giant of Torah, a giant of scholarship, a giant of knowledge. And we spoke about the death of his first wife, his remarriage. And these were real problems in his life, and the seminary offered him financial redemption. From the day he came to the seminary, he never had problems of Panasser again. So bear that in mind. I'm not saying it justifies, but at least one has to understand it. Now, let me go further. My student, Rabbi Dr. Professor Mark Shapiro, delivered a wonderful talk on, it was the Yahrzeit, I believe, of Professor Lieberman, and he delivered a talk entitled Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox. And that talk was later published by the University of Scranton Press, where Mark teaches, and Mark, as usual, uncovers material that is very fascinating. And he quotes in that talk, in the publication on page 36, to give you an idea of what we're talking about and the tension it engendered, he quotes a very cute anecdote that is recorded by Rav Nissen Kamenetsky in Making of a Gadol. And the anecdote is very simple, that Rav Nissen's father, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and Rav Aaron Kotler were at a wedding, and at the wedding, Rav Shaul Lieberman was also at this wedding. And Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was involved in a heavy conversation with Shaul Lieberman. And Rav Aaron Kotler came over to him, and he said to him, you're not allowed to look at the face of an evil one. You all know Chazal say, that Yitzchak became blind because he looked at Esav. It's forbidden. Ein kukina Russia, asul is takel b'pnei Russia, and he told Reb Yaakov to stop talking to Reb Shaul, and Reb Yaakov ignored Reb Aaron Kotler. Now, that story is revealing. First of all, you have to know the background. Reb Aaron Kotler and Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky were childhood friends. They grew up together. They grew up together in Minsk. They grew up together afterwards in Slapatki Yeshiva. So these were two people who knew each other from childhood on. Secondly, it shows the personality difference between Reb Yaakov and Reb Aaron Kotler. And as one who knew both of them, although I knew Reb Aaron Kotler better than Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, but I can tell you, I can understand it. It is very easy to comprehend. Reb Yaakov was a more easygoing person, more accepting, more understanding of the difficulties Reb Shaul had. Reb Aaron was much starker, Yikov Hadin Etahar. And he told him, stop talking to him. Reb Yaakov refused to listen. Excuse me? That's what the Reb Nosson Kamenetsky records. If you want the exact quote, in the improved edition, it's on page 1190, note C. I want you to know, I am studying Making of a Gadol now. The second time, I'm going through the improved edition. And I have to tell you, it's Nosson Kamenetsky, who I know quite well, a genius of geniuses, to put it mildly. He never graduated high school. Gili, are you aware that he never graduated high school? He went to Torah Vadas. He was missing some classes in gym. He never took the classes in gym. He was going to Lakewood to learn. So Reb Nosson never graduated high school. All I can tell you is, as I wrote in my review of the original books that he put out, you need a Webster's Unabridged Dictionary to follow his English. Now, nevertheless, with this story being told, my student Mark Shapiro writes that when the American government was scrutinizing yeshiva to see if they're legitimate and their draft exemption would depend upon this, and they required in 1954 the American government had to know from every yeshiva names of three institutions that accepted credits from Beit Medrash Gavoa in Lakewood. Reb Aaron Kotler turned to Professor Liebman for help in this matter. As one who always treated the yeshiva with the greatest respect despite their lack of reciprocity, Lieberman followed up on Kotler's request, and the seminary gave them a written letter that JTS would accept credits from Lakewood, and it helped Lakewood in getting proper status in the eyes of the United States government. So you see, there's an ambivalent relationship here. It's not like the names I mentioned before. Leave Mordechai Kaplan out of the equation. But see, even Mordechai Kaplan is so hard to deal with, because on one hand, as Yitz Rubin called him, a tremendous apikairos, the man may completely emasculated belief in God. It becomes totally unimportant. God did not reveal the Torah to the Jews. What did Kaplan say? The Torah revealed God to the Jews. You follow me, Shmuel, with all those implications. But Kaplan observed Shabbos. Kaplan observed Kashrut. When you ask Kaplan why, he gave you a beautiful answer. Judaism as a civilization. Now go and explain what Judaism as a civilization means. You know, to me, I can explain you the civilization. You know, as we explained, they can explain it, but one thing is for sure. Lieberman was from. And how do you deal with it? He is a man who was an unbelievable Talmud Chacham. Now, Hillel Goldberg, I'm now on page 43 and I can give you many sources, and this is a very famous story that many of you already know, because why you has told and retold the story. I lived it on the periphery. You know what I mean, on the periphery? Because in the 60s, although I was a Rosh Yeshiva uptown in YU, I was in the rabbinate in New Jersey. So that essentially, my mindset was just shasim paiskim in the yeshiva, just giving a shiur. But when on, I wasn't intimately involved because I took off back to my kehila at 1 o'clock. So the seminary had a terrible fire in the library, 1966. I remember this like yesterday. The seminary never recovered from that fire. Manuscripts were destroyed, were burned, priceless manuscripts, priceless books. Seminary had the richest, may still have the richest rabbinic library in the United States of America. I don't think Yeshiva University's library equals the seminary, and the seminary also has the Cambridge papers that Solomon Schacht brought over from the Cairo Geniza. So when you deal with the seminary, you're dealing with an unbelievable amount of wealth. And then the fire breaks out, and why you students 66 want to go down to the seminary to help save books. The whole process began of carrying out and saving and doing what you can and getting it away from the water. It took, you have no idea what was involved to save what could be saved. Now the Shiloh is, are you allowed to go to the seminary to save these books? Now I have to tell you, if anyone asked me, you'll open up my new book, you read Aaron Rakefet says Eidut Nemana, and I challenge anyone to catch Rakefet telling a fib that when I was a high school kid, must be 52, 53, I went with my Chavruta Chaim Noble, Rav Chaim Noble, one of the great new yeshiva American graduates, great Talmud Chacham. We visited every Jewish institution in New York to try to find out what is truth. That includes all the yeshiva and Satma and Lahavdil, Temple Emanuel, and JTS. We come into JTS, we look for the Beis Medrash. There's no Beis Medrash, it's just classrooms, but there's a big library, a big reading room. That's the focal institution in JTS. Come into the library, there's Reb Moshe Bick, the Posek of the Bronx, Talmud Mufak of Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, Reb Yaakov Emden's great-great-great-great-grandson, sitting in the library with a rare sefer, with his long flowing beard, with his payas, with his bekesha. And I had the chutzpah to say to Reb Moshe Bick, I was a wise aleck kid, Danny, I was a wolf, you understand? I knew too much for a kid of 14. Imagine the chutzpah, I say to Reb Moshe Bick, Mala Kohen Bebek HaKfara. Okay? I'm quoting a medrash. So without batting an eyelash, he says, they should have a sefer, a valuable sefer, and Klal Yisrael should suffer? If they have a valuable sefer that I want to see, I want to look at it. So if anyone asked me, save what you can from the seminary, those books have nothing to do with the seminary, those books have nothing to do with conservative Judaism, those books have nothing to do with Mordechai Kaplan or Louis Ginsberg. These are books, manuscripts that the seminary owns, but it's worth a fortune to call yourself. Yes, sir, would you agree with me? That's what I would have answered. But in 66, one second, you can ask, let me just bring the point home. In 66, what you don't realize, the swing to the right was beginning. You see, there's a revolution and there's always a counter-revolution. You've all studied physics, chemistry. This is so true in life. The Korean War was over. The innocence of the 50s ended. The 60s was mass revolution. The sexual revolution. The feminist revolution. You don't realize what happened at Columbia University Student Street. Do you know what the word street means? Now what does it mean? To run naked through the campus. By the way, Yeshiva University had this. A few kids, the middle of the night, a few kids were streaking on Amsterdam Avenue. It was hushed up, but you understand. you don't realize.
Yeah, you listen to that very funny piece.
There was an incident with Reb Heschel Schechter. You don't even realize Yeshiva was shaking. He walked into the dormitory, and on the wall, some student had a, I remember this like yesterday, a student had a pornographic picture hanging. So Reb Heschel ripped it down. The student threatened to go to the New York Times. His civil liberties have been compromised by a fanatical member of the faculty. And believe me, the New York Times would have picked that up to Motzei Shalom Rav. Thank God they bribed the student, at least they exempt him from classes and Kul Mashiach comes or something to quiet him down. But you don't know what happened. So now, because all this was happening, and you had Jit Greenberg, it's frightening. I remember that machloket, where here you have, he's not a product of yeshiva, he's a product of Beis Yosef from Borough Park. He has smicha from Novadik. And he's interviewed by the commentator, who, you remember this, it all was written up in the YUMUB book of Yeshiva College memoirs. He came out, I couldn't believe my eyes, in the commentator, in the interview, pardon me for saying this, that there's nothing wrong with premarital relations. No? Who attacked Professor Greenberg? No, give me the name. Thank you. Moreno Rabbeinu Rabbanu Lichtenstein came out, and that was the bitter debate between him and Yitz Greenberg. And this is the way the world was changing. Of course, at that time, we never believed the time would come that homosexuality would be considered normative. But already in the 60s, the seeds were planted for all that has happened today. Well, there was a counter-reaction, and the swing to the right begins. Remember, this is the swing that you saw with your own eyes when Aaron Rakepet is interviewed by the Jewish press a few months ago, and they asked me why I'm not wearing a black hat, and you saw the attacks upon me, that I wouldn't have left Egypt, I would have assimilated. I mean, it's beyond words, it's beyond comprehension. I live in Israel, I speak Hebrew as well as I speak English, all my children live in Israel, all my grandchildren live in Israel, I fought in two wars, etc., etc. I wear a baseball cap that was made in China. There was never a case of anti-Semitism recorded in China. Black hats are made in Italy. Mussolini comes from Italy. Ribbono shel Olam. But this swing to the right began. So suddenly it became a big shaila if you're allowed to go down on the 7th Avenue subway from 181st Street to 125th Street, walk over three blocks to the seminary, Broadway and 122nd Street, and help save books from the library. So remember what happened? They tried to reach the Rav. They couldn't reach the Rav. Wow. Fine. He was inaccessible. Why not? It was the middle of the night.
It was 2:00 in the morning.
It was 2:00 in the morning, the middle of the night. He was asleep. What do you want out of him? His wife was critically ill. It's 1966. You're accessible 24/7. What are you, a practicing rabbi today? Those days are over, yes. Today, when I go to bed, no one can wake me up. I close two doors, zehu zeh. Don't ask. We're older people. I have to sleep.
But God sometimes punishes rabbis and makes them show presidents.
That's a different story. That is a rabbinic in-joke, and be careful with it. I don't go into details. Alein l'shabeach. No, kenanalazi b'dicha. Anyway, coming back here, so they called Dr. Belkin. They woke up Dr. Belkin. Dr. Belkin told them to call Rav Shaul Lieberman. And whatever he paskins, that's what you should do. It's a true story, but they called Rav Shaul Lieberman. He told them, come down and save. And then they were worried Stiff Hillel Goldberg, who became a bit right wing later in life, or makes believe he's right wing, wrote, he thought the yeshiva would implode over this issue. People were in favor, you did a wonderful thing, you saved Sfarim, you listened to Rav Shaul Lieberman. Other people said, you're a bunch of apikusim, you called the man who teaches in the seminary faculty. So you see, Rav Shaul Lieberman, very difficult to deal with him, because he had no tinge of conservatism in him. 1 second, Nachum, let me go just, yeah, go ahead on this issue. Well,
did they
add it
wrong?
1 second.
I read that. I thought that Dr. Belkin is making a joke here that Goldberg doesn't get. You say, ask Shaul Lieberman, another Navi's
gift,
you can ask Shaul Lieberman, you can go save the
books. It's not a joke. I don't think it's a joke, but it shows you Rabbi Belkin's respect for Shaul Lieberman. But this is nothing. I just learned something the other day that is overwhelming.
What happened in the morning when your own
book comes? I'm going to answer you in a minute. You get your own answer. Gentlemen, this volume I'm holding in front of me, which I am quite impressed with, is by Rabbi Avishai David. Avishai David wasn't born the great Talmud Chacham he is today. He studied many hard years. In 1968, he was a Talmud in Reb Aaron Lichtenstein's Sheur. Reb Aaron was a young man. He was just beginning to say Sheurim. He had been the Rosh Kollel. He had been the Rav's assistant. I know Reb Aaron from the day I entered the yeshiva in 1951. In my new book, you'll see I describe him as one of the three role models that I had as a student in YU. So Reb Aaron is now giving his shiurs to some very bright students, among them Avishai David. In 1968, Avishai David just told me a few days ago, the fellas were asking Reb Aaron about Shaul Lieberman, because he was a hot topic of conversation. Now, Reb Aaron obviously had entree to Reb Shaul Lieberman because of the family relationship. Whose son-in-law was Reb Aaron Lichtenstein? No? The Rav's son-in-law. Who was married to the Rav's cousin? Reb Shaul Lieberman. So Reb Aaron arranged to take the entire shir to meet Reb Shaul Lieberman. And he told the fellas, prepare any questions you want on Kol HaTorah Kula. You're going to meet someone who knows Kol HaTorah Kula. And Avishai David says to me, he prepared 6 different questions on 6 different sukkahs, on 6 different problems, and he threw it at Reb Shaul Lieberman, and without any sparim in front of him, Reb Shaul Lieberman quoted everything by heart and resolved every issue within seconds. So you see, this answers you, the Rebbe Reb Shaul Lieberman. We're going to come back to this in a second, but it shows you who you're dealing with. That Avishai David, who no one will accuse of being a liberal, no one will accuse him, he wears, am I right, a black hat, a black suit, am I right or wrong? He's a rabbi, he's a shul, he's a Rosh Yeshiva, he wears rabbinic garb. No one will accuse him of being an oisvach, a shegetz, a pushtak, like Rakefet, Chasva Chalila. No one will say he's a rotten, vicious, malicious, hideous, aimless, ruthless, depraved, degenerate, devout, surreptitious individual like Aaron Rakefet. See, I can't even maledict myself. You new fellas, why don't you talk lumdus to me? Who maledict? You know the story of the Chafetz Chaim? This guy was on a coach coming to Rotten, and there's a little old Jew sitting on the coach, and the little old Jew says to him, from Abu Kuntman, where do you come from? Where are you going? He says, oh, I come from a big city, but I want to come to Rotten. Ich will zen the Gadol Hador, the Tzadik Hador, ich will zen the Chafetz Chaim. And the Chafetz Chaim says, nah, es nicht der Tzadik, es nicht der Gon, es nicht der... And this guy gets so angry, he smacks this old little man and says, Azei Redmin af the Tzadik Hador, Chas v'chalila. No, a day later he comes in to see the Chafetz Chaim. And there's this little man sitting there, and he doesn't know what to do. And the Chafetz Chaim says, Anshuldig, you taught me something. You taught me that one shouldn't speak Lashon Hara even on himself. So, all right, you see, God didn't let me finish the sentence because I was putting myself into such a terrible description. Anyway, be it as it may, you see the tension here. Not easy to dismiss Reb Shaul Lieberman. Here's Reb Aaron Lichtenstein with Avishai, with Rab. Then Avishai David, a young kid coming up the ladder, and they're just blown away by Reb Sholei Minin. Now then there's the famous story, Mark brings it down too, where the Sholeitman corresponds with his first cousin, the Chazon Ish, and the Chazon Ish writes back to him, "You're asking me what the source is? You're the biggest bucky in this generation." Okay, but excuse me. They had a relationship. Everyone suffered, but they had it obviously. Yeah, you got to read Mark's entire work now. Yes, Gilly.
Does anybody know if the fire, like what it was called, but someone, is it arson or?
No, it wasn't arson. Electrical. Yeah, God have mercy. There were fires. You should know that in yeshivas in Baltimore, there was a terrible fire in the dormitory, and two young men died. Katz. One was the son of Rav Michal Katz, my Rebbe, and one was the son of his brother. The Rav of Passaic, I think his first name was, I forget his first name. He was the Rav of Passaic. I could check it out, come up with the first name.
Did anybody ask the Rav about the books in the seminary, whether they fell down or not?
I don't know. I can't answer. But if you ask me, he would have said absolutely yes, you can save the books.
Because after they published that, the commentator, the Greenberg, wrote a whole piece in response, claiming that he was the one who told him to go down to save the books.
Right, there was all machloikis between Goldberg and Greenberg, and that machloikis resurfaced 40 years later with all the passion that you could imagine. Because 40 years later, Greenberg already is non-denominational, and Goldberg identifies with Agudath Yisrael. Now, this relationship between the Rav and Rav Sholei Lieberman resulted in one of the most fascinating chapters in American Torah history, a chapter that has been written up, but not really researched to the end. I'll give you my take on it, and much has been written. I can quote to you from Mark Shapiro's book, I can quote to you from Louis Bernstein's book, I can quote for you from Aaron Rakefit's work on the Rav. Much has been written on it. It goes back to the mid-50s. And again, you have to understand that the rabbinical body of the seminary, of the graduates, rabbinical assembly, was still mostly a traditional body. And getting a get was very important to most conservative rabbis. It's not like the conservative movement today. In addition, the head of the Beis Din at the seminary that administered getten was Professor Boaz Cohn. Anyone who studied responsive literature is probably aware of the name Boaz Cohn. His basic research on responsa and on the literature, it's classic. Boaz Cohn was revered by all. The Agudas HaRabbanim accepted his kitten. I've told you more than once, or at least I've said it in public lectures more than once, that I used to hear as a kid, I quote, a professor, Boaz Cohn, can mitzumich sein, end quote. That our professor, Boaz Cohn, efshal lesmoch. He was a class act. Now, get is crucially important, because if a woman remarries without receiving a get, the children from the second marriage are chas v'chalila Mamzerim. And Mamzerim, we all know, is a stigma that we have no solution, and it's a stigma that perpetuates itself. It's not that it will get lost a generation or two later. A Kohen who marries a Grusha, so the child is a Chalal. Alright, so if the child is a Chalal, he's like any other Jew. Ultimately, he's considered a Yisrael, and that's it, forgotten. A mamzer remains a mamzer with all the limitations. And I have to tell you, I don't know how many of you have seen mamzerim. I have. It is a tragedy of tragedies. And a different story. The Medrash already says it. The Medrash Rabbah, the Ma'at Asukim. I had a student right here. I don't know if it was in this building yet, in Neely, in the early years of BMT. I don't want to go into any detail because I don't want anyone, Chas v'Chalil, to identify him. But his story was very simple. His parents were not religious. His mother and her first husband were not religious. And they married, and they were married in a country where 90% of all marriages, kedat v'kedin, chuppah v'kedushin, 95% of all marriage. And later they had a big argument, and he refused to give a get. He was holding her up, and she ran off with another man. They went to a Reform rabbi, and the Reform rabbi said, you don't need a get, the hell with the get, I'll marry you. And that animal went and married them, and they lived together and had children. And later in life, that child, as a young teenager, became a Baal Tshuva. And later his father became a Baal Tshuva. But I don't know intimate details. I was told that they went to Gedolei Yisrael, and no one could find the heter for this boy not to be a mamzer. I questioned it because I've been involved with heter mamzerim, Baruch Hashem. Every case that came my way, I was able to help find a way out, al pi halacha. Obviously, it's not just me. It needed Gedolei Yisrael, but I played a role in the thinking, the process, the situation, etc. Here, no solution was found. So this young man, you should know, has never married. He's not so young anymore, he's well into his 50s. His father is not a poor man, bought him a big business in Israel. He has panasa, he has success. He davens 3 times a day, he learns Torah. He never, ever married because he didn't want to communicate the stigma to his children. It is terrible, horrendous. So if you recall my lectures, yes, Gil, I haven't said a word yet. Go ahead. If you recall my lecture.
Can you marry a woman who's awesome?
Okay. Say that, I'm telling you, we could have found, I was never consulted lahalacha. They said they went to Gedolei Yisrael. I don't know the intimate details. Nothing has been published, nothing has been written. Although in one book, A History of This Community, it does allude to this case and tells you that this young man is a mamzer and how the reform. It does allude to the story showing the tragedy when you remarry someone without a get. Because you never know. Everyone has freedom of choice in life. And you all know from studying Tanakh, the greatest tzaddikim had sons who were rishayim, and the greatest rishayim had sons who were tzaddikim. Correct? Right or wrong? Look at Moshe Rabbeinu, and look what happened to his grandchildren. So the Rav cried plenty, and many a drasha on Moshe Rabbeinu. I have a lot of Torah and insight from the Rav. The price one pays for being in the public limelight, for being a Rebbe, for teaching Torah. This is a tragedy. We have to do everything we can to avoid this tragedy. Because the Rav and Rav Shaul Lieberman were related, they had a familiar relationship. They met on occasion, they met on Smachot, they spoke to each other, and they came up with an idea that has become known as the joint Beis Din. Now, Mark Shapiro, when you read his little booklet, his wonderful booklet here, so Mark claims that the joint Beis Din is a misnomer because all the members of the Beis Din had to be Shomrei Torah and Mitzvah. I don't agree with Mark. I think the joint Beis Din, as I call it, and as Louis Bernstein calls it, I think what it means by the joint Beis Din was that this was a Beis Din that the conservative and the orthodox were going to agree upon, were going to set up jointly. Now, the initiative and the guidance would be in the hands of the Rav and Rav Shaul Lieberman. And the idea behind it was that the Beis Din would have Rabbanim who were acceptable to the Rav and to Rav Shaul Lieberman, which meant right away that you would have people who were 100% Torah Jews. Boaz Cohen, from the RCA you would have representatives, and it would be fabulous. And all gittin would go through their hands. And the conservative movement would have to insist that anyone getting a divorce, every conservative rabbi, you send the people to this joint basin. And if this is the case, we would eradicate almost all the fear of mamzeret in the United States. The reform, answer your own question, look into Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, the marriage is not a marriage, the Eidim are not kosher, they don't do it properly, the chances are there was no condition to the other, they don't need to get, there was no more than what we call civil marriage.
But follow
what?
The heter of
Moshe. Well, it's only Reb Moshe's heter. If we wouldn't follow that heter in the state of Israel, the whole country today would be 2/3 mamzerim. What are you talking about? The Russian immigration? You know how many times they were married? Forget about reform. Civil marriage. Of course we pass from Reb Moshe. But not always, because with a conservative marriage, there's a much bigger problem. Generally speaking, many conservative people were married by Orthodox rabbis. Yeah. Their parents insisted upon it. Then, we're talking the 1950s. Nah, it's a different world today. Talking the 1950s. I'm going to come to it next week, you'll see. Okay. Now, the Rav gave his haskama. Rav Shaul Liebman was certainly not a problem. Anecdotal evidence has it that even Rav Aaron Cutler agreed not to disagree in public. Okay? That Byron Cutler, by the mid-50s, was a force, a tremendous force on the American scene. You've got to stand in awe of a man that totally influenced hundreds of thousands of American Orthodox Jews, the 50s, the 60s, until today, Lakewood. Rav Nosson Kamenetsky's book in Chayrim, burned in public. Mind-boggling. One little Jew, Rav Aaron Cutler, was all of 5'1", 5'2". But what a bren in his eyes. Okay, we'll talk about Rav Aaron, it's not for now. It's, I'm planning something down the line, but it's years away. God should give strength. I know Yitz gets upset, he wants Kalat Torah Kula Regalachat. It doesn't work that way. To do it properly. Gentlemen, with all that was said, the idea fell through. And a lot of people have written, why has the idea fell through? I'll tell you what my conclusion is, and I believe I'm correct. Mark Shapiro quotes a few different ideas, I know other ideas. I'll tell you what I conclude, living the era, having researched the era, and I believe I'm correct. Gentlemen, for the Rav to agree to this, it was a major step to the left. Because when all is said and done, you are giving credence to the conservative movement. The Rav was willing to agree with all the danger involved to save Mamzeret. What an achievement. But here was the problem. By the 1950s, the mid-50s, the conservative movement was starting to draw very far apart. It was becoming a major umbrella. There were many trends within the conservative movement. The sociological reality of America was changing. We'll talk about it next week. And there were many conservative rabbis already who refused to make the halacha obligatory. And these conservative rabbis, they were the minority, but they were vociferous. We cannot force our people to go for a get. If they don't want a get, it's their privilege. We cannot force them. And Shaul Liebman had to admit to the Rav he could not bring the entire conservative movement into this deal. The Rav put a condition down he's willing, if I can quote Rebbe, and this is what I heard, I was a kid then, I didn't hear it directly from him, I don't want you to think in the mid-50s I had the guts as a little high school kid to go over to the Rebbe and say, Rebbe, what are you thinking about on this joint based in? But I am told that the Rebbe said, I'm willing to lose my Olam Haba to save Mamzeret, but only if I know it's saving Mamzeret. But the minute Shaul Lieberman told the Rav he can't deliver the entire movement, it fell through. It did not succeed. The Rav couldn't agree, because Mamzeret is going to be Mamzeret and Mimanav Shach. Those who care will get a proper get. Those who don't care can't be coerced. Once they can't be coerced, Ma ho'ilu chachamim b'takan tan. What have we achieved? That's my take. I stand on it. But I beg you or people listening, do research, come up with a master's thesis, could even be it can be connected to a doctorate. What is the real story behind the joint based in, and why did it fall through? But one thing is for sure, if not for the relationship with Mori Urebi, Rav Soloveitchik, and Professor Shaul Lieberman, this would not have gotten off the floor.
Did yes. It begin in the 70s?
What?
Did it begin in the 70s?
I don't know if it was tried again. I think it was just simply raised again, but it was a dead issue. In the 70s, it did not get off the floor. In the 50s, it was a serious proposal. A lot of ink was spilled on it. Meetings were held, people were involved, David Hollander was involved, Kelman from the seminary was involved, and by the way, David Hollander was in favor on the condition that all conservative rabbis would agree. He sided with the Rav, and it would have been a fabulous achievement, no mamzeret. It fell through. Yes, Michael.
I'm familiar with the book Jew versus Jew. They tried a similar thing, not with Gittin,
You're talking about Denver, Colorado.
Right, and it exploded.
But that was the 1980s.
It was much later, but it was a similar kind of a model.
Right, but you got to
be done under the auspices. Ultimately, the conversion would be done under the auspices of Orthodox.
Right, that's where they got the solution in Israel. Rabbi Lamb brought that same concept here,
right.
But it could never take hold. It can never take hold today, because there's a much more dominant right-wing element, which at times goes beyond the halacha, but they have a very strong voice. You know that in Israel right now, and they set up a committee to investigate the gay rebellion in Sahal. This is against every concept of halacha. It's against every concept of hilchot gerut. There's no such concept retroactive annulment. These are people that have observed, if not everything, something. There's not one post. The greatest machmir and gerut was Rav Avram Yitzchak Cohen Cook. In the Haredi world, so-called popular language, all the poskim were more mekil than Rav Cook. There's a Beit Yitzchak, there's Achiezer, there's Rav Moshe Feinstein, and take a look what they're doing. Not only that, these people are gerim. How are you allowed to insult the ger? How are you allowed to be mavayish a ger? How are you allowed to put down a ger? Look where we're at. But this is the reality today. And a voice like you have just heard is a kol korei bamidbar. No one listens. No one has power.
People who do not know Layman don't see in the paper that there are rabbonim who are against the Haredi misuse.
I hope it's not Haredi misuse. It's just total misuse. It's frightening. And you have a chief rabbinate that is laughable, mamish laughable. When you think of Rav Cook, when you think of Rav Herzog, when you think of Rav Elzio, when you think of Rav Nissen, when you think of Rav Unterman, and you think Rav Avadji Yosef, Rav Shlomo Gorin, and we have a chief rabbinate today. It's just Rav Avram Shapiro, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, and look what we have today. It's a chuka utlula. Yes. I don't know. I can't answer that. All the literature says is that it was a minority. And from what I understand, the vociferous minority that refused to go along with it. It's obvious that the overwhelming majority of seminary graduates in the 1950s would have gone along with it. But you had that miyut hanikar that refused. And that was the bone in my Rebbe's throat. Now, it's the Rabbinic Assembly, not United States.
So they weren't officially working. They weren't going
Yeah, we're talking about Professor Liebman was dealing with, we're going to talk about that next week, Rabbinic Assembly, but hold on. Now, I want to go one step further, and I want to show you something amazing that I have heard from people with my own ears. Page 48, Professor Shapiro, Mark, pardon me for calling him Mark, my student, he also goes with the name Melech Shapiro, many different names. What are you asking? Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox is the name of the book. It's a booklet. It's about 75 pages, I would say. Anyway, on page 48, he records the following story. Professor Liebman wanted to build up the Talmudic faculty at JTS. So, of course, having come from Israel, he knew everyone. It was a who's who in Israeli Talmidei Chachamim, and he knew who had brought him. One of the people he brought to the seminary was Professor Chaim Zalman Dzimitrovsky. That is a famous name. Like, there's a Rosh Yeshiva, I believe, in KBY today. Dzimitrovsky, maybe his son, his nephew. This is a Litvisha family who later studied with Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook in Merkaz HaRav. It's a family that broadened, and Professor Dzimitrovsky, again, 100% observant, a tremendous Talmud Chacham, but added to his learning was a scientific approach. So, Lieberman visits Israel. Yeah, yes.
How does one spell the name?
Dzimitrovsky. I'll spell it for you. D. Here's the way he has it here. Dzimitrovsky. Yeah. Dzimitrovsky. Chaim Zalman. So Liebman visits Israel, and he gives Dzimitrovsky a contract. I don't have to tell you, a person working in Israel making $2,000 a year, and suddenly you're going to New York and you're making $25,000 at the seminary. Guy was the happiest guy in the world. When he comes to New York, he sees it's a conservative institution, you know, and he understood it was scientific. Lieberman is teaching there. He had no reason to question its religiosity. He thought the whole difference between JTS and the Orthodox Yeshiva was the approach to the study of Talmud, something we've spoken about 5-6 years ago in our lectures on the history of Torah in modern times. Watch. It was not until his arrival in the United States that he realized that JTS was an integral part of the conservative movement. Since he was Orthodox, he wasn't sure he could fulfill his contract. And he asked the Lubavitcher Rebbe what to do. Now, you have to understand something. Again, when I say the word Lubavitcher Rebbe, right away, David has a smirk on his face. The Rebbe, the Mishigas, the Mishigas, the Balei Tshuva. You don't realize who the Rebbe was in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. Everyone consulted with him. When Rabbi Riskin had to do something, who did he consult with? The Lubavitcher Rebbe. When people wanted to go on Aliyah, Mechanchim, who did they consult with? The Lubavitcher Rebbe. And many times the Rebbe told them not to go, and some didn't go, some did go. So he went to the Rebbe. And the Rebbe replied, quote, "As long as Professor Liebman is in the seminary, you can stay there. If you resign, it won't make a good impression. If he decides to leave, then you can leave as well." So you see, here is the Lubavitcher Rebbe telling Professor Dzimitrovsky, "Rav Shaul Liebman is there, you have to remain." You know something? Professor Dov Zlotnik, Professor Aaron Kirschenbaum told me exactly the same stories about themselves. You recognize these two names? These are graduates of the seminary. Big Talmidei Chachamim, totally from. Talmidim of Professor Lieberman, and they felt very awkward. At a later point, teaching at the seminary, the world was shifting under them. They had students who were Machalel Shabbos, students who had no regard for anything that was Teredic. And they went to Lubavitcher Rebbe, and the Rebbe told them, remain. Your Professor Liebman is there, you stay there. Maybe you can still do good. Maybe you can influence. So it reflects the Lubavitcher Rebbe's thinking as well, that he was not willing to give up on the students in the seminary. And it is true, there always was a miut, a minority, but they came out of the seminary filled with knowledge, filled with dedication, filled with Yirat Shamayim. And they had teachers like Lieberman, like Slotnick, like the Zimitrovsky, like Kirschenbaum, like Avraham Sofer, who we mentioned last week. So it's very, very difficult when you deal with Professor Lieberman. How do we evaluate it? How do we look at it? He gave the seminary its Hechsher, its Stolzkeit. On the other hand, he gave the seminary Yiddishkeit. Those who sought it had a Rebbe. Now, we'll come to it. Why are you rushing? Enjoy understanding Professor Liebman. Enjoy gaining knowledge. Gentlemen, a volume came out a few years ago that, believe it or not, I have a connection to. The volume was published by the seminary, Saul Lieberman, The Man and His Work. It is by two students of his, Elijah Scheichet and Solomon Spiro. And these are two students, one was in the rabbinate a long time, one was in the rabbinate less, one into business. But one of these authors, his own children were my students, and he told me he has four children, three of them are Haredim because of me. In other words, I pushed them on the path to total Torah, and once they started rolling, they embraced the Torah, belay v'nefesh, and they wind up in the Haredi world in Israel, or what I call the semi-Haredi world in America, because you know the Haredi world in America, in Israeli standard shmuel, they would consider them phonies, fakers, charlatans. Rakefet is honest, at least he admits he's a tzionidati. But you guys, Americans, go to college, go to university, have root for the Yankees, cry for the Phillies, etc., etc. You know, you're not real Haredim, you don't even realize what I'm saying. When Satmar came, there was a big thing, the previous Satmar Rebbe came to Israel, so they had to tell their Hasidim, no one is to bring a video camera, because your cousins in Israel will not understand a religious Jew having a video camera. Okay, a video camera means you have to have a TV, you have to have a computer, you have to be able to show it, you take videos. Oh my gosh, you're Martin, you're no longer Satma. Now, they did a biography of the Rebbe. It's called Saul Lieberman, The Work and The Man and His Work. Now, the biography is not a critically scholarly biography. I imagine that awaits the passage of time and someone who didn't know Professor Liebman, but it's a very warm biography of Talmidim who you can see loved their Rebbe. And there's some very fascinating material in the biography. They talk about his first wife, the tragedy of her death. They talk about his second wife. They talk about his heartache at the university, how they wouldn't let him go for a doctorate. And of course, ultimately, he was in terrible poverty, and he comes to the seminary, which they understand. They don't have the problems we have, but they do write that when he comes to the seminary, the Orthodox rabbinate in America went crazy against him. Why? And again, it all comes back to Mordechai Kaplan. How can you sit on a faculty where Mordechai Kaplan is one of the dominant, if not the dominant figure, a man who probably doesn't believe in God, certainly doesn't believe in Matan Torah, in a divine giving of the Torah. A letter is published in Hapardes. Hapardes, familiar with it? It is the Rabbinic Journal of America in the 30s, into the 40s, into the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. I would say it was the most popular rabbinic journal, edited first by Harav Pardes, for whom the journal is named. He is the founder, Shmuel Aaron Pardes, and then afterwards by Rav Simcha Elberg. And they published this letter challenging Shaul Lieberman, how could it be that you teach at the seminary with Mordechai Kaplan? Now, Shaul Lieberman writes a long answer to the editors of Hapardes, but he makes it conditional that the letter not be published. Hapardes did not publish the letter. Only after Liebman's death, when they went through the archives, did they discover the letter, and it's published for the first time in this volume, beginning on page 56. I'm only going to quote part of his response, but it's extremely fascinating because it shows his mindset and how he viewed the seminary. As far as teaching at the seminary, Rav Shaul Liebman says, before he left Israel, he went to three Gedolei Yerushalayim and asked their advice. Two said he can take the offer, one said no. The first would not say whether his teaching at JTS was permitted or prohibited. The second said there's no prohibition. The third said that Liebman was the right person to teach at JTS and wished him success. Who are these two people? We don't know. They interviewed Lieberman's Talmud Mutak, Professor Dov Zlatnik. Have you heard the name? I daven with him every morning at the 5:30 meeting. Dov Zlatnik was the Talmud Mufaka Professor Liebman. His greatness is dealing with Mishnayot. I can say Eved Nemana, that Professor Zlatnik knows every Mishnah and Shas by heart. All you see him doing is learning Mishnayot, reviewing. Of course, he's published a great deal. So they went to Dov Zlatnik. How do we know it's the Talmud Mufak of Liebman? I'll tell you how close he was to Professor Liebman. Professor Liebman died without children. Dov Zlatnik was named in Lieberman's will as the executor of his estate. So that tells you how close they were. Professor Zlatnik speculates that the three might have been, remember, he's speculating on the basis of what he knew about Liebman's relationship with Chachmei Yerushalayim, Chief Rabbi Yitzchak Herzog, okay, Rav HaRashi Leretz Yisrael, the Chief Rabbi of Yerushalayim, Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank, and Liebman's father-in-law, Reb Meir Berlin. My guess is that if this is true, and I'm only guessing, don't quote it as fact, his father-in-law is the one who told him, I don't know whether you can or can't. Why did his father-in-law talk that way? Because you can't boss your son-in-law around. Mm-hmm. A son-in-law is not a son, and even a son you can't boss around at a certain point. It may very well be that Chief Rabbi Herzog, who knew Lieberman, felt that he would be the right man in the seminary. Rav Herzog had been exposed to general knowledge, had been exposed to scientific Jewish knowledge. Rav Herzog himself had a doctorate in marine biology, and Rav Herzog was broad, and he understood Lieberman. You might be the right man at that time. The seminary was not yet conservative the way it was today. It had a very traditional element within it. Could be. And Rav Tzvi Pasach Frank, who has many children, many descendants, who wound up in the United States, particularly Chicago, a good deal of chinuch in Chicago, was built. The Sachs family, Rav Tzvi Pasach Frank's daughter, it could very well be that he said, fine, go. Okay. That's number one. Did you get an answer from your father, by the way?
Yeah, he said, if you can, you would love to test.
Okay, so do me a favor. Speak with me, call me at 9, and I'll make a time to give it to you. I'll tell you even better. Will you be here tomorrow? When are you going to be?
Wednesday, and next Monday.
Well, wait. Wednesday's no good for me after crowning a tooth. Monday. Okay, so I'm bringing the set with me next Monday.
Okay, what's
your
number?
You don't have to call me.
No.
We just agreed.
Thank you.
Okay, 1 second, just let me write down. Monday, set. Got it. Okay. Next, and this is very important, tell me. I admit with the tributary of Moshe Feinstein. What went on in the Talmud Torahs in New York? Can anyone tell me? The New York area, the Philadelphia area. Wherever they, what were Talmud Torahs? Do you fellas remember? These were afternoon schools. This is long before there was a massive day school movement, and the only education most Jewish children got was by going to an afternoon school at Talmud Torah. No? How did you make a living then? The Altamir came to New York, graduates of Torah Vadas, graduates of Chaim Berlin, some graduates of Yeshiva University. So you taught in the day school in the morning. In the afternoon, you taught in the Hebrew school, in the Talmud Torah. Half the time, you taught in the Talmud Torah. Two-thirds of the time, it was a conservative temple, it was a reformed temple. Were you allowed to teach there? No? Who was asked this question? Reb Moshe Feinstein. And Reb Moshe gives the famous tshuva that many other rabbanim gave. Absolutely, you're allowed to teach as long as no one tells you what to teach. In other words, if you come into a Talmud Torah and they tell you to teach, God does not exist. You're allowed to drive the shul on Shabbat. Kashrut is only important in your home. You can eat whatever you want outside of your home. Then you're not allowed to teach. But if you're free to teach, and you know how many kids became frum, this is before NCSY, hundreds and hundreds of young people, there must be tens of thousands of descendants of children at Talmud Torahs who were made frum by their Rebbe. So that's exactly what Liebman says. No one tells me what and how to teach. At JTS, I was given the freedom to teach whatever I wish to teach and however I wish to teach. So that's also a point. No one came into his class and told him, you have to teach conservative Judaism, you have to teach Catholic Israel, you have to teach it's permissible to drive the shul on Shabbat. Chas v'chalila. This is very important. JTS officially recognizes the authority of the Shulchan Aruch. As long as that remained the official position of JTS, there was hope. And here too, what Liebman is telling you is a very dated statement. Nevertheless, in Lieberman's time, that was correct. The official position of JTS was loyalty to the Shulchan Aruch. Loyalty, what did it say in its preamble that I read to you weeks and months ago already? Loyalty to the Torah Shebechtav and loyalty to the Torah Shebaalpeh. So you see, this was Lieberman's mind, this was his framework. Later in life, and someone mentioned this in class, remember the letter that Mordechai Kaplan got, which affected his health, and his son actually writes that it brought about his untimely death.
Louis Ginsburg,
thank you. Mordechai, Louis Ginsburg, Professor Shaul Liebman got exactly the same letter, found in his files. For the sake of financial remuneration and glory, I've sold yourself to the other side, meaning the devil, the Sitra Acher. you know that you are lending prestige to Mordechai Kaplan. May his name be blotted out. And to the other heretics at the seminary, as well as to the graduates. Is your presence at the seminary necessary for the spreading of Torah, or is it the glamour of being a professor among ignoramuses with a comfortable salary so powerful that even Saul Lieberman is not man enough to withstand it? Do not deceive yourself that you will change the seminary. You will be influenced by them, and you will be separated from the society of scholars who have not sold themselves to financial gain. Oy la Russia, v'oy la Shechina. Better to be a poor rabbi in a little synagogue than a professor who produces rabbis who are chodim and machtiei a rabbim. There is yet time to repent. Yours truly, a friend. So, you see, he got that same letter. We don't know if he responded, but you can understand his mindset. He was there, he was happy, he did his scholarship. He was caught up in a web. I think he recognized it, certainly by the late 70s into the 1980s. He recognized it very well. He fought it. He did what he could. He had some success with some wonderful students. Overall, of course, there was no success at all. And finally, I come to an article that had a bit of an impact, as a matter of fact, on his York site. Let me just see if I can figure out which York site of Professor Lieberman it may have been. His died 83, so it may have been his 30th York site. 30th York site would be, it may have been his 25th York site, etc. So they had a memorial meeting in Jerusalem, and the main speaker was a Talmud of Professor Lieberman, who's still at the seminary, Professor Roth, I believe, and he gave his whole talk on Professor Lieberman based upon the article I'm about to quote from. Gentlemen, the author of the article is someone named Aaron Rakefet Rothkopf. The article is called A Note on Rav Shaul Lieberman and the Rav. What is the story behind the article?
Where did it appear?
Tradition. It appeared in Tradition 2007, Tradition number 40, the 40th year, the fourth issue. 2007. Excuse me? I can make you a reprint. It's no big deal. I have it. Anyone else want a reprint? Reprints. Okay. So I'll make at least six. Okay. I have it in my office. I just have to copy it. Okay. Now, why did I write this article? I wrote the article to defend my Rebbe's cover. What happened was, in the work of Professor Lieberman by Shochet and Spiro, they mentioned that Rav Moshe was desperate to find Parnassa for his son, Mori Rebbe, Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, and he turned to the seminary in the 30s asking them if there would be a place for the Rav. Could you imagine asking them if the Rav could teach at the seminary? And they published this. So I wrote this article to show that this was impossible, that the seminary at the time was already considered trash, and I interviewed a gentleman. Amazing. An hour and 20 minutes, just like yesterday, it starts making noise. I don't understand it. It's like telling me, Rebbe, slow down, you got to end soon. I interviewed a gentleman who died just a few weeks ago. He may have been the oldest living Talmud of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik of that era. He lived across the street from Yitz. One second, let me get Let me just see if here I have it. Rabbi Louis Simonson, who was a 1935 graduate of Yeshiva College, got smicha in 1937. And I interviewed him, and Rabbi Simonson was a great Talmud Chacham. Am I right or wrong? He was a Jew who knew Shas. And he was far from being a right-winger. In other words, this was a Talmud of YU, of the Soloveitchik family, and he told me it's absolutely impossible. The seminary was considered treif, and that theory holds no water. I proved with another source that the theory cannot be correct. I don't want to go into great detail, but if you're familiar with Shulamit Meiselman's memoir, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik had a tremendous battle in Warsaw at Tachkamoni because the dean of the school, Reb Meir Balaban, taught with a scientific approach. So if he had a battle in Warsaw, and if he fought a tremendous battle at Yeshiva College with Professor Zalman Seitlin because of the scientific approach, how would he send Rabbi Yosef Dove to teach at JTS with scientific? So I reached the conclusion it's not true, and I cite all these sources. I also cite Mark Shapiro, who similarly, my student Mark, similarly reaches the conclusion it's not true. But what's fascinating here is I discuss another part of the book. And here, they quote Reb Heschel Shechter. I have it in my book on the Rav. Reb Heschel paraphrases the Rav. I quote the Rav word by word. And a number of times, the Rav mentioned this. I give you the exact quote, so you can see it in context. It's in the Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Volume 2, pages 27 to 28. And you see, the question is, what was the relationship between the Rav and Professor Liebman when it came to learning, when it came to an approach, when it came to giving a shiur? And the story is as follows. The Rav was talking about Tumat HaMet. And the Rav spoke about the fact that Tumat HaMet is a very unique and singular concept. There's something about Tumat HaMet that absolutely defiles human emotion, the human soul. Look what happens to a person who lived, who studied, who did mitzvah, who had tremendous knowledge. And he dies, and that's Tumat HaMet. And he says, this is why, I'm paraphrasing the Rav now, this is why a Kohen is not allowed to come anywhere near Tumat HaMet. He's enjoined from defiling himself to Tumat HaMet. Unlike other Tumat, where if you want, a Kohen can defile himself. Let's say he sees a sheretz, a dead lizard or something, and he picks it up and he defiles himself. So you're metaya yourself, you go to mikvah, it's not a terrible thing. But Tumat HaMet, you are enjoined from defiling yourself. And then the Rav told the story. I remind myself, I had an encounter a number of years ago with a representative of the so-called school of Chachmat Yisrael. He was a very outstanding scholar. The Rav did not mention the name. But we later found out the Rav was talking about Rav Shaul Liebman. It seems when the Rav told the story years later, he did mention Liebman's name. And Rabbi Lichtenstein knew it was Liebman. But when I heard the Rav say it the first time, he didn't mention a name. And he says, they were together at a family simcha. They were sitting together. He told me that lately they had discovered a parchment, a Megillah scroll, in which it was stated unequivocally that a Kohen is enjoined from defiling himself with the sheretz. Follow me? Not just Tumat HaMet, but a Kohen is not allowed to go near a sheretz. I said to him, do you take it seriously? Of course, he answered, very seriously. And the Rav comments, you know, they, the devotees of Chochmat Yisrael, have the answer right away. It is a different Kabbalah, a different tradition. They operate with a traditions in the plural. In other words, the Rav here is criticizing Chochmat Yisrael. You find a manuscript, you find a Ktav Yad, 1,000 years old. A coin is Musar al Tumat Sheretz. So right away you say, there are traditions here. So I mentioned a name to him. This name was known to him. And I knew he did not like the person. I asked him, do you know him? I don't know who the Rav is referring to. But it's evidently another professor at Hebrew University. Do you know him? Yes, he answered. Is he a scholar, I asked? No, he is a boor and an Aretz medial writer, he answered. A total ignoramus. That's what Professor Liebman answered. I said to him, quote, so only we have a monopoly on boors and Amei Haaretz medial writer? 1,500 years ago, there were also boors and Amei Haaretz. Since there was no paper, the boor had to write on parchment. So you found nice Chiddushei Torah. So what? And the Rav adds on, that is a true story. Now you can get the source in my work, the Rav. And what I quote is better than what Rav Heschel quotes, meaning he paraphrases it. I'm quoting the Rav word by word by word. Okay. Now, what does this tell you? And I go on to explain it, and this was the talk that Professor Roth gave that night. You have worlds in conflict here. It's two different approaches. The Rav was the traditional Briska. He never budged. And in traditional yeshivish learning, you're not going to be overwhelmed by different traditions and different manuscripts. This is the lundus, this is the halacha. No, you found the manuscript. So an Amoritz wrote a love letter to his girlfriend, and he quoted a pasuk, and it got stuck in the Cairo Geniza. And you find it 1,500 years later, and you come up with a whole theory that great Rabbanim courted girls by writing quotes from Nach. All right. So famous, if you're familiar with Making of a Gadol, I'm playing games with something that happened in Making of a Gadol, right or wrong. Now, Rev Shaul Lieberman had a scientific approach, although not entirely. I have to give him credit. He was not like Professor Levi Ginsberg. He was not totally scientific. He's been criticized for it. But he certainly had a much broader approach than the Rav. And he finds a manuscript. To him, it's impressive. Wow, Kol HaMusar al Tumat Sheretz? This has to be analyzed. The Rav could never be impressed by that. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't, as the Rav once said at a Yachay Kala that I listened to by tape, dealing with the whole question of a takana or a gezeira of Shelda Chachamim. Does it reveal Das Torah or not? Is this God's will when Chachamim make a gezeira? When you can't eat chicken in milk with milk, is it just as bad from the point of view of HaKadosh Baruch Hu of not being able to eat meat with milk? Or to put it very simply, if someone walks into this room with steak covered by sour cream, I don't know how you would react, but I would throw up. I would puke. Steak covered by sour cream? What about if someone walks in with roast chicken based in butter? Would you throw up? It's a very interesting question. Who deals with the Meshech Chachma, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman? So the Rav was discussing this question. So a student shoots at him from the audience in Maimonides in Boston during the Yachay Kala, Rebbe, what about the Maharal? And the Rav reacts, the Maharal is not in my base medrash. Now that is a brisker approach. That is a Litvish Yeshivisher approach. Professor Liebman could never answer that way. The Maharal, you have to investigate, you have to see another viewpoint, another shita, another manuscript. It's a different approach. And it's very hard to compare these two giants because each one was functioning within his own understanding of how to study and how to learn Torah. So this is a very interesting point that I comment on in my article. Let me make one more point. I'll come to Professor Heschel next week. You're in for a treat. And I'm going to tell you next week, you're going to dance with joy. It's my own chiddush. You'll see what I have to say. It's based upon something they said, but we got to leave that for next week, and then we come to the world that Michael's referring to. Let me go one step further. These two students were the Rebbe's Talmidim. Although Liebman frequently played the role of an austere, demanding, and demeaning professor in the classroom, he cared deeply for his students. I'm quoting from the book by Shochet and Spiro. His style of teaching, which became condescending at a time, was not dissimilar to that of other scholars such as Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who reportedly treated his students in a similar fashion. He made a special effort to capture the interest of his class, stating that to teach Torah, you must be an actor. And he accordingly spiced his classroom lectures with Juma anecdotes and drama. This is amazing, because reading that description of Professor Liebman, I could apply it 100% to the Rav in my time. And sometimes I have to plead guilty. I feel very bad, and I'll say to the class, your lack of knowledge is showing. You follow me? The Rav would show us how little we knew. He could put us down. In my time, wow, he was demanding. He was frightening, you know. Gave sheer. You didn't challenge him till you were with him the third or fourth year. Rav Heschel Shechter didn't open his mouth the first few years in the Rav's shiur. Later, you gained a little confidence, you gained a little bit of friendship with the Rav, you opened your mouth, but he was frightening. But as frightening as he was a fabulous teacher. When he told the story, wow. We can repeat line by line. People have come to me, Rav Heschel Shechter, Rav Abba Brunspiegel. Did you hear this from the Rav? Repeat it the way we heard it. I can remember the way the Rav told it. We're talking 1957, 58, 59. What are we talking about? 50 plus years already. Can I inherit? I can repeat it syllable by syllable. When he told the story, you were caught up in his world. He transported you to a different time, a different place, a different civilization. And here I want to tell a true story, which I write about in the article. Rav Heschel writes this up. I don't know if I wrote it up or if I just told it. I think I wrote it up as well. We were ear witnesses. I and ear witnesses to this. It was a Yotzai Shir. You got to know what a Yotzai Shir was. You can't even start to conceive of it. The Rav would begin at 8 o'clock and he'd still be going strong at 12 midnight, at 12, I don't know how he had the strength. I told you, I spoke it for the Lysia Jason at that memorial, so a guy comes over to me, a few people come over to me, and you say, Rabbi Rakefa, we could have listened to you all night, why did you stop, why did you end? So I answered them, I said, look, that you could have listened, I don't deny, but do you think I would have to kayak to teach all night? I said, I wouldn't have the car to go out all night. The Rav transported you, the halacha, the agata. Ah, the agata. I told Rabbi Avishai David in his first piece here, he quotes the Medrash, Bori Olamot Umachrivan. And while you don't realize what I could do with that little medrash, what the Rav taught me, when I've added to it, oh, I can all of Yiddishkeit I can put into that midrash. When I'm finished teaching that midrash, you are going to be a committed Torah Jew, 100%. From the Rav. So the Rav finishes this tremendous Yahrzeit shiur. This has to be about 59, let's say, 58. And Rav Heschel and I are sitting fairly close. We're already committed of the Rav a few years. And the Rav finishes, it's 12:30, and he slumps over, sitting behind a desk, microphones in front of him. And this rabbi from Brooklyn comes over to the Rav, and he says, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rav Soloveitchik, Agresin Yashar Chayach, Yizait, I'm repeating it syllable by syllable, Yizait Agresa Aktor, you're a great actor. And without batting an eyelash, as tired as he was, the Rav responds on the spot, acting is 90% of teaching. And gentlemen, and to those listening across the world, if you're in chinuch, go to acting school. Because if you're a good actor, you'll bring Maimer HaSinai into the classroom. Revelation before the eyes of your students. And those students will be real B'nai Torah. And that's the Rav. And that's the point I make here. And boy, I live it. I think of it. I still see it in front of my eyes. The crowd surging forward. Yashakayach, Yashakayach, Rabbi Yashakayach. And this rabbi has the chutzpah to say to the Rav, putting him down. Rav Soloveitchik is like the Agresa Aktur.
Maybe he wasn't putting it down.
Have it your way. Wow, Yitz is really a reformed individual. He's become a Chanai, Melamed Zchut. Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem, a reformed individual. I didn't say, God forbid, I didn't say it's a reformed with a small R. Gentlemen, to reiterate. All right, Baruch Hashem. First of all, thank you for your kind comments on yesterday's shiur. It's just beginning. You'll see how it's such a world with the Besamim Rosh. I was always fascinated by that literary forgery. It always, how could he pull it off? I'm going to show you in Talk today. People believe it's legitimate. But then we'll start doing the tshuva inside.
What if he would not have done it as a forgery? If he would have presented his own views...
Okay, that's a good question. We'll see what the views are.
He could have made the accountant post through...
Yeah, but he couldn't express some of those views in public, as you will see. Okay. But it's fascinating. Today's shiur we dealt with Rav Shaul Lieberman, and you have to admit, it's a complex relationship. He could not be dismissed. And the whole Torah world until today has a problem. I just met on a different, nothing to do with London, nothing to do with learning, simply to do with buying tickets to get on an airplane. So the person I'm dealing with is his family. It's the Chazon Ish's family. So I told her, you're related. You're a cousin to Professor Liebman. She says, of course I'm a cousin. You understand? And I don't know if they're proud of it, but it's a problem, and everyone knows his lumdus, his knowledge, his bekiya, his svarim. It's an unbelievable topic. But he was at the seminary and certainly played a tremendous role in keeping commitment to Shulchan Aruch. Influenced a few students, underlined the word few, but we have to do it. What, Michael?
Well, why is it possible for someone to separate the two? What does one have to do with the other?
What do you mean? One
his scholarship and his brilliance and his contribution?
Because he was at the seminary, knew this is the heart of the problem. This is why he asked the Shaila, should he go, shouldn't he go? This is the heart of the problem. Would you teach at Hebrew Union College?
That's not the issue. The issue is a scholarship.
That father?
It is a tremendous contribution.
No, no, the saints. So you're saying that the scholarship will live on and JTS will be forgotten.
It's meaningless, ultimately. Yeah, it's
a problem because he gave it. Anyway,
it doesn't affect the level of what he produced.
Anyway, next week.
Orthodox rabbis invited here at the Hebrew Union College to teach.
Right.
Would it be wrong to do?
In my way, absolutely. I would.
You have young men and women.
Yeah. So let me tell
you.
So let me tell you something. You know, someone who teaches at Hebrew Union College here comes on sabbaticals, teaches there, goes back and forth. It's a Wayu Musma. His two sons are married to non-Jews. That's what came out of it. One of them is married to a non-Jew, an Afro-American as well, which may be to his credit. I don't know. But it's very sad. Anyway,
that's because he gave lectures
It gives you an idea when you associate who the kids grew up with, where they spend Shabbat, etc., etc. You don't live in a vacuum. Professor Liebman had no children, so that issue would be very interesting if he had children to see where his children are today.
So it's meaningless.
What do you mean?
Judging it,
you can't judge. No, I understand. You can't judge. I understand. But that's a good yardstick to
Joel
judge.
Was Joel Roth one of his students?
Yeah, sure. Joel Roth, he's the one who gave the memorial talk, and he used my article as a springboard. Yes?
Is it right here in
Pulpitz? Of course.
He's very observant.
100%. But he was in a conservative temple all the years. You understand? It's not so simple. That temple had mixed seating, but it was a traditional service outside. David Feldman. He has a son who's a big Talmud Chacham on the YU faculty. A lot of people in his shul became from.
I heard once that Moshe Feinstein was shown one of his works. He said if you hadn't told me that you didn't have I guess it wasn't five, but from whatever, so I wouldn't have known.
No. He writes. I'm telling you, it's 100% from 100% in his writings. In his lifestyle, in the children he raised, Baruch Hashem, his son, what's his, Daniel Feldman, is a big Talmud Chacham. Yes. We'll talk about that. Savlanitis. Okay, gentlemen, first.
There aren't those who dismissed the rabbi because he's what he should.
Absolutely. What are you talking about? Of course, there was opposition. There is still is to the rabbi.
You know that when Meir Shalom, every time they put out a little booklet, of Gedolin, a photo of Gedolin,
right.
You'll never see Rav Soloveitchik.
Of course, he's not in their world. Relax. Gentlemen, this is from yesterday's Yediyot. Here's the article that shook up the world, this yeshiva student about the yeshiva world, and if this article is true, we are in big trouble. The title is Ha'avreich Shesha'ar, the Avreich who cried and yelled at him. By the way, he sounds very logical, you know, in his explanation.
What is the main thrust of what he's saying?
That the Chiloniyim are friars, and there are a bunch of idiots for supporting the yeshivas, because what happens is no one goes to work. If they wouldn't be supported, they would go to work. They would be normal. And he says, many of the youth want to be normal, want to be part of the greater society. Today you can be part of the greater society and be Haredi, there's no problem. But he says, we are so fenced in because if we leave the yeshiva, go to work, it's a disgrace for our families. But if the support would end, we would have to face reality. Also, he makes the point that I'm afraid we all understand that so many kids are sitting and learning. If they sit for 8 hours, maybe they learn 1 hour out of eight. He says, there are a few who are real matmidim, but they are the gedolim of the future who would be gedolim no matter what. But the average is far from that. It's a very frightening article. So I spoke with someone last night. They said maybe the newspaper made it up. Next, I want to tell you that Yitzchak and I became poorer because we both own Manel Li'Igeret. Manel Li'Igeret is now on the website. You can pick it up, the whole Manel Li'Igeret. This is the website. So Yitzchak and I thought we had a treasure. That treasure has dissipated. Next, if anyone wants a copy of Rabbi Avishai's book, they're taking more orders.
Who's taking?
Here, the guy just came. It's 60 shekel. If you buy it in Meir Sharim, it's 120 shekel.
Sure.
So, you got me marked down for 5 copies?
Yes.
Paid in advance.
That's me.
At Yitz Rubin.
That's me, yes.
Marked down. Finally, I want to show you where David comes from.
The money or?
Money.
David Pardo. This is from Yang Yisrael, a Shentri city. This is their catalog for the year of their scholars. I got to tell you, no one does it like the Yisrael Century City, which uses Hollywood people. Go Organics, Young Israel Century City. Got it, Rabbi Muskin. And every month they have so much doing, and everything here is healthy and good. I tell you, it gets the Rakefet Award for the greatest catalog that can attract Agbalidai. My dear students, until we meet again in health and happiness, thus the
Dania. You know what they had in today's paper? A young boy, age 16, was not given admission to a hotel in the,